I know. That one's hard.
Hey, Gugatz.
Sometimes people, like, do I say burrito? Oh, I see. I see. All right.
This meeting of the Senate Environment and Energy Committee will come to order. We're going to start with Senator Tomasoni with Senate File 2793.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. And Mr. Chairman, I think we should do. Can we start out with the amendment, or do we have to wait?
Sure.
For
Senator Hoffman, there is a quorum. Let's check in. Senator Hoffman moves the A2 amendment, I believe, with the fix, and that is on line 12 of page 1, David.
Yeah, Mr. Senator Chairman, Thompson. It says expressed. It should say espresso.
Good.
Espresso bill.
Okay, no.
Lots of people
guess,
like, okay, express. You wanted to strike the ED.
Well, strike the ED and the incorporate that into the amendment also.
So Senator Hoffman incorporates that in the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 2793 is a very interesting bill, and it's an energy-saving bill. It's a bill about allowing companies who have existing microenergy loans, as well as people who are having large amounts of energy being basically wasted, to figure out a way to save the energy and ultimately save a lot of the costs of doing business. And I know I was down at a conference in Chicago, a Midwest Energy Conference, and it was all about energy efficiency. And it's pretty interesting how much you can actually save just by doing things differently as opposed to maybe doing something new. And so this is a very interesting bill from the standpoint of being able to save a lot of energies for a lot of big energy users. And I believe that the funding mechanism for this is also pretty creative. And so I'll let Dave Foster take over from here and explain what's going on here and how the bill works.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Foster.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Tomasoni and members of the committee. My name is David Foster. I'm the executive director of the Blue-Green Alliance, a Minnesota-based nonprofit organization that works to identify ways today's environmental challenges can be transformed into economic and job-creating opportunities. I'm here today to express our support for Senate File 2793, authored by Senator Tomasoni. This legislation will authorize $100 million in state revenue bonds to the Minnesota Department of Commerce for an industrial, commercial, and public energy efficiency revolving loan fund. To do so, it expands the existing microenergy loan program and provides the commissioner the authority to issue low-interest, long-term loans to units of local government to finance these improvements. The Blue-Green Alliance, over the last 3 to 4 months, convened a diverse group of industrial stakeholders, including the Department of Commerce, the St. Paul Port Authority, the United Steelworkers, and companies in some of our most energy-intensive industries like taconite and pulp and paper, including U.S. Steel, ArcelorMittal, Rock 10 here in St. Paul, Sappy Paper up in Cloquet, to identify the barriers and solutions to energy efficiency improvements. The primary challenge that we identified is financing of the large upfront costs associated with these kinds of projects. This is an especially important finding for Minnesota's taconite and pulp and paper industries, which are in constant pressure from global competition and face high internal hurdle rates when seeking capital investments. But right now, with low interest rates combined with the potential of larger scale energy efficiency projects, makes authorizing revenue bonds for a state revolving loan fund a good economic investment for our state. Access to upfront capital will accelerate the development and size of these initiatives and increase large industrial and commercial users' returns on investment, assisting them in overcoming internal barriers. The St. Paul Port Authority has demonstrated evidence of how such revolving loan programs can and should work. With its current Trillion BTU program, the Port Authority has provided resources and financing for energy efficiency projects throughout the metro area. They estimate that a $20 million public investment would generate over $100 million of renewable energy construction projects with food manufacturers alone in our state. The Blue-Green Alliance believes that a $100 million revenue bond authorization, like the one in Senate File 2793, would also allow hospitals, other commercial and public entities to increase energy efficiency initiatives throughout the state. We ask you to support Senate File 2793 because it provides a tool for financing industrial energy efficiency improvements statewide, from food manufacturers to taconite mines and pulp and paper mills. This is by no means a comprehensive solution, but it will help to make these further investments a reality while also achieving the benefits of energy efficiency to companies, including lower energy costs and increased international competition, which is extremely important, as well as benefits to the community, including reduced pollution and the creation of additional quality family-sustaining jobs. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Foster. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Rosen first, go ahead. Okay. Mr. Foster, I was curious if some of the large industrial customers and so have you been in conversations with them, or you're just trying to get this going because once the loan program is in place, you think there's going to be real interest? Because I think that was one of the concerns I heard about people not necessarily being interested, but this should be win-win for them, right?
Yes, we had three extensive face-to-face meetings. One convened here in St. Paul, another up in Cloquet, and one, I believe, in Duluth, where we discussed in great depth all the barriers to industrial energy efficiency projects that were being experienced by major consumers of energy here in the state. And that included a very diverse group of companies. I gave the names of four of them, but Boise Cascade and International Falls took part. 3M took part in one of the meetings. HealthEast, even a healthcare company, was interested in this subject. So I think there's a lot of concern about this, a lot of interest in seeing our state become a leader in this kind of energy efficiency.
Thank you. Senator Tomasoni, you want to call the witnesses in the order they're on the list? Or
it's up to you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, well, we'll just go ahead. Rory Lauder from St. Paul Port Authority.
You want to rest?
And next would be Bill Grant from Department of Commerce.
And he just walked in, too.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for your indulgence. I had a 10:30 post-operative eye appointment, and I just saw the doctor at noon. You know how that goes. So I appreciate it. I'll be very brief. My name is Lori Lauder, and I am the Senior Vice President of Business and Intergovernmental Affairs for the St. Paul Port Authority. And while we don't have a formal position about this bill, we have been asked to share with you our experience in energy financing. So I would like to take a couple minutes and just mention our Trillion BTU Energy Efficiency Loan Program. I want to thank the legislature and governor at the time for signing off on a bill in 2009 that provided the ability of the St. Paul Port Authority to work with Xcel Energy in joint venture partnership to provide these loans in the Xcel Energy Service Territory. That joint partnership is going well. We have booked, Mr. Chair, about 50 loans to date. They are all across various cities: Minneapolis, Bloomington, White Bear Lake, Coon Rapids, Brooklyn Park, and so forth. The total amount with these 50 loans that have been provided to private sector companies, and these are for large industrial commercial energy users, that has provided over 150 billion BTUs saved. And it has provided the creation and retention of over 900 jobs. And one of the things that we're very pleased about is that these companies have been able to keep their doors open and save so many trillion BTU. And, Mr. Chairman, let me correct myself. It's 500 500 billion BTUs, a half a trillion of BTUs saved. I apologize. And so the other thing that we're very interested in is working with other entities who wish to kind of emulate some of the good parts of this energy loan program. And with that, I would be happy to stand for any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Gowder. I think that's, in other words, you, the Port Authority's bonding, is it, are your loans funded also by revenue bonds or?
Mr. Chairman, they are not. And, of course, the bill up, as we understand it, would be taxable revenue bonds that would not come out of the treasury of the state, nor would they, as we understand it, would the state have a general obligation pledge. These would be bonds purchased by the private sector. What we also accomplished in 2009, thanks to the legislature and governor at the time, was $5 million that came through Bill Grant's operation at the Department of Commerce. And then we also had some matching money from whichever municipality we lent the loan, in which we lent the loan. And so it was a matching kind of situation with dollars that came from the federal ERA money. So Federal Department of Energy to State Department of Commerce to the St. Paul Port Authority. And it's a revolving loan, so we are now starting to use some of those repayments on new loans. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Grant or Bob Ryan, either of you?
Thanks, Senator.
Both? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce. Start by reminding the committee that last year Senator Dibble had a bill to ask us to work with stakeholders to really look at our conservation efforts statewide and to drill down on a couple of issues in particular. One of those was industrial energy efficiency, the subject of this bill. And through a very robust process that resulted from Senator Dibble's bill, identified financing for industrial energy efficiency projects as one of the top needs and one of the unmet needs in the current financing schemes that are available. And so we are excited to work with the Blue-Green Alliance in crafting this bill. We think that it's one tool in the toolkit. There is not going to be a silver bullet in terms of what the best vehicle for financing is going to be. It's going to vary from company to company. It's going to depend on the interest rate that results from the bond sale and so forth. And we hope very strongly that local government participation will be part of this process so that we can help buy down the interest rates that result from the bond sale, make them as attractive as possible to industrial users who we do believe have deep energy retrofit capabilities that aren't currently being taken advantage of. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you.
Has.
Questions for Mr. Grant? If not, thank you. Mr.
Thank
Ryan.
You, Mr.
Afternoon, Chair and members. My name is Bob Ryan. I work for the United Steelworkers. And before coming on staff with the Steelworkers for 32 years, I worked in St. Paul's most energy-intensive company, Rock 10 Paper Mill in St. Paul. Our members work throughout the state in some of the most energy-intensive operations there are, including taconite and pulp and paper. I'm here today to encourage you to support Senate File 2793. With that, our state is uniquely positioned to take advantage of the enormous potential for industrial efficiencies, particularly in manufacturing. In 2006, 32% of the total energy used in Minnesota was used by industry, more than any other sector there is. For energy-intensive industries, efficiency improvements have the potential to save the companies energy and money while modernizing production and increasing our long-term competitiveness in this global market. Efficiency improvements lead to energy savings, and once the initial investment is paid, the improvements lead to cost savings from reduced energy or fuel use. Other states have capitalized on the benefits of industrial efficiency. Ohio's Energy Loan Fund provides low-cost loans that support efficiency and renewable energy improvements like combined heat and power. The program has helped institutions and companies across Ohio, including Kent State and Timken Company, achieve their energy savings. These improvements will help our companies to remain competitive in the international market, create quality jobs, and reduce energy use and pollution. And I encourage you to support this bill. With that, I stand for question.
Thank you, Mr. Ryan. Questions from the committee. Is there anybody else in the audience who wanted to speak to the bill? Let me ask that first. And then is there any discussion from the committee? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that this was my bill, that I passed this bill, the original language for this bill.
You okay, can have
thank
it
you.
Back.
There are some hands. Short-term memory, but I believe this is a really good bill. So, Senator Tomasotti, it is good, and I appreciate the broadening of the definition to energy efficiency. Several questions I have is, and probably for Director Grant, if he could come back up, how the program has been working, and how does that work again as far as the application for these loans? I should know this.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rosen, the program hasn't been working for several reasons. First of all, the definition was problematic. Microenergy was not defined in the statute. We were unclear about to what purposes the money could be put once we had sold the bonds. Secondly, and I think that this is problematic going forward, the sale of revenue bonds doesn't necessarily result in below market rate interest loans, which for most people in commercial sector, industrial sector, that's going to be a requirement. They can get a bank loan if all they want is a market rate interest. So the program has not been, the bonds have not been sold, the program has not been operating, primarily because of the problem with the definition. And we think expanding the definition is a most helpful development.
Okay. Mr. Chair, thank you for that, Director Gray. So my concern is, and just from the testifiers, and I'm, again, going to go into a little more greater Minnesota, we've heard from mostly industrial, you think of large industrial, and I've heard paper mills and the mining industry. I would like to ensure that there is equal distribution as necessary or as best as possible through the entire state, because we have, we obviously have industrial throughout the entire state, and I just don't want to see, a lopsided approach to this, because I do think this could work. And and also, when it was explained to me by Mr. Ryan, something about nursing homes, well, that really doesn't fit into the definition here, except maybe under, I don't know, public energy efficiency projects. I'm not quite sure, but we need to make it so there is so the entire state is a win-win and not just a portion of the state, Senator Thompson. So with that, I would like some help from council to perhaps craft some language that would make.
Council said that the law, which you may have authored, has talks about geographic distribution of projects throughout the state.
Is it in here?
On page 2, line 29. Already in there, in other words. So you were thinking about that a couple of years ago.
Apparently I was. That's good.
Yeah, I was going to say, Mr. Chair, I don't think there's any bill that Senator Rosen would offer that wouldn't have geographic distribution. But could I ask perhaps council to address the nursing home question? Are they considered a commercial entity? Would nursing homes be considered a commercial entity?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't know. I mean, it's if they're for profit, you know, what's the definition? We don't have a definition for commercial. I would say if I wanted to have them covered, I would mention them, I think. I'll defer to the department if they have a current interpretation, but as a general matter, they're different than a commercial entity, particularly if they're nonprofit. So are they covered otherwise?
Maybe Senate Council can look into that, because I think we've usually used commercial industrial to refer to almost all business for and nonprofit businesses. So maybe we can have them check in as we continue along, and we can always, if there's additional need, I have a feeling the authors are looking at covering as many entities who might be able to benefit from this as possible. But let me ask if there's further discussion while they're looking at that. Senator Tomasoni, we did not have a request from the finance chair, but it does seem to me this is in your turf because it's revenue bonds, even though it doesn't have an impact on the state budget. Did you want to see the bill? I mean, I know you said it.
I would think to keep it alive, I should probably see it. Yeah.
It's either going to the floor or to your finance division. You like it, your finance division, you can send it on if you don't want to.
Well, how about if we put it on the floor and then I include it in my finance bill? I could probably do this, do both.
Probably do it either way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
Is there further discussion on the bill?
Chairman, just out of curiosity, if it goes to the floor, is it a deadline issue or no?
No, well, it's not moving in the House?
I don't know.
Well, it doesn't matter wherever we send it. If it's a deadline issue, Rules Committee will capture it, and you want to consider it in finance, you'll have the ability. You'll know it has. If
let's
it has
it passed,
the,
let's send it to the floor. Then that's always a better place to be.
You think there may be a need for it? Anyway. Senate Council is thinking there may be a need for it. I just keep thinking we've used commercial industrial to apply to basically all kinds of business entities. And Senator Rose.
What is the definition? Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the definition of commercial industrial? I even Googled it, and I couldn't quite get a clear picture of what does that mean?
I'm going to suggest somebody look in Google in our statute to see what commercial industrial, where we define it in statute. Does people want to keep working on this here? Because I think the intent would be to make sure we cover that and any other entities that might be able to benefit from this. But my guess is we're going to say that covers everything anyway. But do you want to have it resolved here, or do you want to consider it later, Senator Benson?
Mr. Chair, if this is going to the floor, then perhaps we could lay it on the table, do a little research, and the committee... there are no co-authors, unfortunately.
We can add them.
I think I've already expressed interest in that. I like this bill a lot.
I don't want to slow this bill down. It seems like a good idea, but I want to respect that Senator Rosen. I think healthcare facilities, if they're not covered by commercial, could be called out so that we make sure we broaden options.
Rather than spend a lot of time, why don't we put that in it now and when you put it in? Yep. Senator Rosen moves... whatever Senate Council says.
Right? The rest of the day off. On page 2, line 4, after business, put comma, including health care facilities, comma.
Page 2, line 4, after businesses mm-hmm. including health care facilities, comma. Mm-hmm. Is there a discussion on the Rosen Amendment? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Benson, I'm sorry if I...
That's all right, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask Council about page 1, line 15, if we needed language there as well. just seeing industrial and commercial. I'm trying to read it in context.
Mr. Fuller thinks it's less necessary there. Why don't we, I have a feeling this is, since this bill itself will not be, it's going to be possibly part of Senator Tomasoni's bill, maybe we'll have them work it further, because we do have at least the intent expressed that we want to include.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought it was moving to the floor.
This bill is moving to the floor, but the House Companion did not. Okay. It's probably moving to Rules Committee, technically.
Okay.
Is there further discussion of the bill? If not, Senator Rosen moves Senate File 2793 as amended be recommended to pass.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Would Senator Rosen like me to add her name to the bill?
Is a co-author?
Sure.
Anybody else?
I'm sure. Let's talk about that, Mr. Chair. You know how we love to barter.
Senator Rosen's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you all.
Chairman,
good luck
committee
with
members.
Senator Eaton, I guess you have to leave soon, so you taking yours up next. Welcome to the committee. Senate File 2555.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a residential solar energy systems bill, and the bill establishes rights and responsibilities for individuals who live in homeowners associations and for the associations themselves in relation to solar energy systems. So I'll let my testifiers here explain the details.
Hey, welcome to the committee, Mr. Abbey.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Ross Abbey. I'm a policy associate at Fresh Energy. I want to thank Senator Eaton for authoring this bill. This bill, actually last year she authored the first iteration of this bill. It was part of the Solar Energy Cost Reduction Act. It did not move forward as part of the omnibus bill, so I'm glad that she brought it back again this year. I want to speak briefly to three items: the need for the bill, what the bill does, and also the process with the stakeholders, how we got here. What the bill does is helps clear away red tape and a lack of clarity that exists for homeowners within homeowner associations when it comes to putting solar panels, either solar hot water or solar photovoltaic, on their roof. We know from last year this committee and the legislature passed the solar energy standard. We're expecting something like a 30-fold increase in residential solar here in Minnesota in the next 5 or 6 years. But unfortunately, we've got some market barriers here. Fresh Energy and other stakeholders identified these market barriers back in 2012 as part of the Solar Challenge project. That was a partnership with the Department of Commerce, Xcel Energy, Fresh Energy, and the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, DOE-funded research. And what we found is there's really two barriers that exist at the HOA level. A lot of homeowner associations, there's over 7,000 in the state, estimated. Most all of them have no process in place, no clear guidelines for what solar system, what type of solar can and can't go on the roof. And so when homeowners try to approach the HOA board or their design review committee with a project, there's no standards in place. A lot of these boards are volunteer boards. They don't know solar. They know they've got questions. And they know that if they let one homeowner do it, that could establish a precedent. And so there's really a need for guidance and clarity and improved process here. That's 95% of the problem. The other 5%, much, much smaller issue, is there may be some homeowner associations in the state that have an explicit prohibition on rooftop solar within their HOA documents or their board documents or their those land-based contracts. And so this law would address both. This law is not particularly innovative. 22 states have already taken this step of clarifying rules in this situation. And the way this bill does that is it establishes that, first, homeowner associations are not allowed to have just a flat prohibition on rooftop solar systems. It also requires that when a homeowner submits a project for review and approval, that the homeowner association will review it in the regular course as it does for other architectural modifications, and that they'll let the homeowner know within 60 days if the project's approved or if there's need for modifications. The bill goes beyond that and clarifies a lot of authorities that the homeowner association has in this case. There are seven, I believe it's up to seven, allowable conditions. This is section subdivision 4, and I can walk through those if there's interest, but basically seven different conditions that any OHOA can put on individual homeowners. And then in addition, the homeowner association could go beyond that and impose any other reasonable restrictions. If there's some dispute over what's reasonable, then at that point it might go to an arbitrator or it'd be a dispute situation. But basically this bill preserves the authority of homeowner associations to make as many to redline the project, to make as many changes as necessary as they see fit to meet their aesthetic targets. I should mention the applicability. It does not apply to all HOAs because we are balancing two interests which potentially could conflict, the contract rights and the expectations of the neighbors versus the individual rights of the property owner. This bill only applies to the estimated 1,000 or so HOAs where a homeowner owns the roof over their head and is also responsible for the repair, replacement, and insurance of the roof. So for the most part, that's homeowner associations that are kind of single-family neighborhoods on single-family lots. The bill also may apply to some townhomes where you've got adjoining walls, but again, only if the individual homeowner owns the roof and is responsible for repair, replacement, and insurance of the roof. I want to mention briefly the stakeholder process. As I said, this bill's been in development for some 16 months now. The last two or three months, we've had really helpful and really intensive exchange with Community Associations Institute. It's a Minnesota chapter of a federal organization, national organization, as well as Common Interest Communities Minnesota, which is part of the Minnesota Multifamily Housing Association. Through that dialogue, we've better understood their concerns, the processes that are already in place at HOAs, and we have we've worked on three amendments with those guys. All three amendments are now within the Senate file. And I think with those changes, we think we've addressed most all the concerns that they've raised. There was an amendment before coming to this committee. The bill went to Senate Judiciary Committee, and there was an amendment in that committee to add the effective date. That is the effective date. So that's at lines 3.5 and 3.6. And what that would what that does is it limits the bill simply to HOAs that are formed after a date in the future, the date of January 1st, 2015. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So it's not going to apply to any existing homeowner association. It's not just whether the project would be started after then. If you're in a townhome association or something, it would not apply.
Yes, it was an amendment that it was an oral amendment that we received in the committee, not Fresh Energy's preferred form of the bill, but that's my understanding that only new homeowner associations that are incorporated after that date, this bill would apply to them.
Questions from the committee? If not, Mr. Hinkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lynn Hinkle, H-A-N-K-L-E. I'm policy director for the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. I'm here today to lend support to Senator Eaton's bill, Senate file number 2555. It's a pleasure to work with the senator, and you know we're glad that she's been continuing to open up the market for solar with legislation such as this. We also appreciate the work that Fresh Energy has done, in particular convening stakeholders and making sure that the rights of homeowner associations have been thoroughly incorporated into this bill. We support this bill for two basic reasons. I mentioned one just a minute ago, which is balancing two rights, essentially the rights of homeowner associations to provide reasonable guidance in the construction and installation of solar energy on their properties, but it also balances the right of homeowners to enter into a beneficial construction and installation of solar panels on their property. Up until about 2010, there was some anecdotal evidence that with the installation of solar panels on a residential property, that it had the impact of increasing that property's value. And in fact, there was some evidence that on the resale of the property owner was able to recoup virtually all of the installation costs, including financing. In 2010, the Lawrence Berkeley Lab concluded a 9-year study examining over 72,000 transactions in California involving, I believe it was 31 counties, a very robust study. And at the conclusion of the study, it was clear that more than just the anecdotal evidence was available, but that with this data, it was clear that homeowners did, in fact, recoup all of their investment in solar PV installations on their property. They didn't even calculate the benefit, the energy savings benefits, which would have been largely in excess of what the return was on the sale of the property as a result of the installation of solar. So what this bill does is open up the market, create an opportunity for homeowners that are part of homeowner associations to participate, to take advantage of that financial benefit that other residential homeowners have been able to take advantage of, not only in Minnesota, but throughout this country with the installation of solar panels on their roof or on their adjacent property. With that, I'll conclude my remarks by simply summing up that we believe that this balances two important rights, that it opens up a significant opportunity for homeowners that are part of homeowner associations to achieve the benefit of solar installations on their property, and it balances the rights of the homeowner associations to provide reasonable guidance in the construction and installation of solar on those properties. With that,
thank you.
Stand for any questions.
Questions from Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this whole balancing of rights, you're telling homeowners associations that they have to do this. Yes, it's prospective, but you're not giving them a choice going forward. And even those that, in the language, an application is deemed approved in 60 days. We've heard a lot of permitting bills in Energy and Environment committees. No application I've ever seen is deemed approved if the agency doesn't get back to you with an answer. I mean, we're really tipping the scales here. You said homeowners associations are, I'm sorry, Mr. Foster, homeowners associations are largely volunteer, but if they don't turn around an application in 60 days, it's deemed approved. Well, we have professionals and agencies given 180 days, and if they don't get their work done, then the project doesn't go forward. And so I don't think there's balance here. I guess I'm disappointed because, you know, good idea. Homeowners associations should have uniform standard guidelines and a process. Good idea. But that we're telling homeowners associations, you have to allow this, and if you don't get your paperwork done, the project gets to go forward. There's not balance here. There's maybe more than where you started, but it's not there yet.
Mr. Abbey?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson. Yeah, 60 days is a little bit tight. One of the issues we see with homeowner associations The truth is there's a lot of variability. Some are professionally managed. Some meet regularly. Some don't meet at all. We had a member in another committee stop said that she was aware of a homeowner association in her district that had been set up in such a way where they couldn't even elect board members. Another person talked about there was never a quorum, and so they're so through this process of fact-finding and research, we determined that simply going with the timeline or whatever timeline currently exists at the HOA, sometimes there isn't any timeline. But this does set up a process where the homeowner will apply to the design review committee, tell them what the project's going to look like. The design review committee can make any of the allowable conditions changes. They can prevent it from going above the roof peak or over the side of the roof. They can make sure it stays on the roof, not on a side yard or not on a wall. They can require it be a licensed contractor to perform the installation. They can require that the homeowner put the HOA on the certificate of insurance. So if there's any change in status to the homeowner's insurance of the roof, the HOA will be automatically notified. They can also, any damage to common properties or the neighbors caused by the installation is allocated to the homeowner who went ahead with the solar. The HOA can also make the person, the homeowner, take the solar down if it's necessary for repair or maintenance of common elements. They can require that the solar system be certified by a national body. That's something that typically you don't, you know, the state doesn't currently have any requirement for that, but the HOA can require it. And they can make any other changes that are reasonable. And if the changes they make increase the cost of the system by no more than 10% and decrease the production of the system by no more than 10%, so, for example, flush mount on the roof versus prop mount, southwest-facing roof versus southeast-facing roof, that's under the statute that would be presumed reasonable, meaning they would go before the arbitrator or judge with a presumption that that was reasonable. But they could go beyond that if it's reasonable. And this, in terms of the 60-day deadline, that simply imposes a requirement on the HOA to get back to them either with request for design changes, request for more information, some step. Whether 60 days is the right time period or 90 days would be more appropriate, I think it's hard for me to say. It is a little bit arbitrary to pick one number versus the other. So I guess I'll leave it at that.
Mr. Benson.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Foster, the 60 days, yes, this is an issue, but deemed approved is the challenge. So if they get all their paperwork turned in and nobody calls them and says, hey, we're missing this, the project goes forward no matter what. And then the homeowners association is in the position of having to take action and they don't have recourse. I don't feel like there's balance. We're compelling a homeowners association, and then we're limiting their ability to sort of defend homeowners association position. I think the allowable conditions are well thought out, and you know we've got some boundaries on what reasonableness is, and I think that that's fine. We're you know accomplishing some things we need to accomplish. I just have. As I've said before, I have a problem with forcing a homeowners association to do it and then deeming approval for a permit.
Mr. Chair, Sir Benson, if I could point out, my understanding of the allowable conditions is an HOA could write those into its bylaws or design review criteria on day one. So they could do that in advance of receiving any applications. And then I hear your perspective. Certainly deeming it approved, if they don't hear back, that does put the onus on the HOA to take quick action when they receive an application. Part of the, I think, urgency with timelines is we now have some rebates and some other financial benefits that are available to homeowners, but those often have cutoff dates, and there's often a timeline on that side as well.
Mr. Knopf, could you speak to how about zoning laws, how they deal with this sort of issue?
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just mentioning to you that I think the where they got the 60 days from is the that's what we do for local government decisions. They have 60 days to approve or deny, and they and it's deemed approved if they don't respond within the 60 days. If there's additional information required, they can get additional time for that. In fact, then the 60-day clock starts as soon as the additional information, as soon as it's complete. But I'm guessing whoever, I've not been involved in this, but I'm guessing whoever wrote this had that in mind when they looked at the 60-day provision and the approval if there's no response. It is similar. It's 15.99. It's a state law that covers local governments. And if there's anybody here representing local government units, they can tell you how they comply with that.
Further discussion. Senator Eaton, the one I not serving on judiciary, I'm assuming you weren't necessarily fond of the effective date. It struck me as that's kind of, we're not going to allow anyone that's even starting for another year to be required to go by this. And then on the other hand, the 60-day thing, and it seems like one is very tight and the other one is you're excluding everybody until a year from now. So it's not a project. In other words, if I'm a homeowner in one of those townhomes or single-family houses in one of these things, I can't get it in a year from now. It has to be, I have to at some point after a year from now move into a homeowners association that's created after that date. Was there discussion of that in judiciary? I'm just curious.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon proposed the amendment, and her concern was that people signed the contracts with their homeowners associations, and that she was concerned with the those people being forced to go against the contracts.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Eaton, I'm just curious as to why solar is the only one included in this. Why not include wind in this?
Geothermal.
Senator Eaton.
My bill's on solar energy.
But, Mr. Chair, Senator Eaton, I understand that, but I think the overall goal is for alternative energy sources. So I'm just wondering why the carve-out for solar and not other sources.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, our understanding of the reason that we focused on solar is that we have some pretty compelling evidence that homeowners who are not part of HOAs are able to recapture the full installation, the full value of the installation, including the financing at point of sale. We don't have the same kind of evidence for other renewable energy installations at this point. At the point that evidence, that information becomes available, I think it would be appropriate to expand the scope of opportunities that would be available to homeowners. But at this point, we're essentially using the data that's available that supports the financial benefit that would accrue to owners that are part of a homeowner association in the event that they installed solar on their roof.
Chair, Senator Brown, if I may, that was also part of the conversation with the stakeholders, as mentioned. I think Common Community Associates Institute has would have a real concern with any sort of small-scale wind in this situation. You know, at the very least, I think we'd be looking at different allowable conditions, different restrictions, a different balance between those interests.
Is there further discussion? Is there anybody in the audience who wished to speak to the bill? Is there further discussion from the committee? Not Senator Eaton? Moves this bill, it has not been requested by the committee. Senator Eaton moves that Senate File 2555 be recommended to pass. Any further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you. Senator Sparks. Yes.
Okay.
And this next bill, just so people know, it passed out of Senator Sparks's committee and got stuck in rules on the way here. And we are hearing it for informational purposes because this may well end up in, I'm told it may end up in the Ag Jobs Omnibus Bill. You're being considering it for that. And because this is an issue of interest to this committee, I think it would be important for the committee to hear briefly what you're talking about and so on. And so for you and your witnesses, it would be helpful if they keep the presentations very brief and give the committee a chance to raise questions or whatever about it. Because we cannot act on the bill. The bill is not technically in front of us. It would have been after the next floor session.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. I appreciate your interest in reviewing this language and for the opportunity to have Senate File 222 in front of you. This is the biodiesel bill. It represents a compromise worked out with many of the stakeholders. The bill makes just a handful of changes to the current biodiesel statutes, and in light of the time, and I know you guys are up against a deadline, I'll turn it over to Mr. Jerry Schoenfeld from the Minnesota Biodiesel Council to walk through the bill quickly and answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you, Senator Sparks. Mr. Schoenfeld, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I do work for the Minnesota Soybean Growers and the Minnesota Biodiesel Council, and I'll run through this very quickly in terms of the bill changes. One of the original law that is on the books was passed in 2008, and there were some delayed implementation dates for going to B10 and B20 at that time. And initially, the B10 was intended to go into place in 2012, but there were some caveats that had to be met before it could go there, and so it was delayed 2 years further. And so we are at a present time in a situation where it would go into effect under the present law July of next summer. And so because of that, the first change that was made was it didn't make much sense to go from B10 because of the delayed implementation that we had to B20. So we delayed the B20 three more years to 2018. In addition to that, there were discussions that accepted relative to the month of October because people were concerned that people would buy fuel in October. And the reason for the summer month use only on B10 is the fact that there can be some cold flow issues. And so the idea was that by knocking off October, we took care of that concern going into the winter months. The last thing pretty much was that for a number of years, there had been exceptions that had been in place within the law for a number of different entities, ranging from taconite equipment to logging equipment and so forth. And discussions with those people, we agreed that we would make those permanent exemptions. We've never had them, and we've never actually had those usages in place. And the next last thing was that in there initially, because number one diesel fuel operates differently than number two diesel fuel, it has a little different chemical structure and therefore doesn't work quite as well with biodiesel. So we always had an exemption for number one diesel fuel, but the concern is that it was exempted during the winter months, and they asked that it be year round. And the reason for that is that number one typically is not used in the summertime because it's much more expensive and it doesn't have as many BTUs, so it's not used in the summertime normally. But they were concerned about the fact that they, since it was offered for sale, that they wanted to stockpile it in the summertime because we used to have a situation where you could get number one pretty much at any terminal, but now it's down to about two terminals. And so there's a shortage, and they had a real severe shortage this winter with it, and so they've asked to have that extended throughout the year so they can stockpile it in the summer.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, just quickly, I was just going to, since this is the Energy and Environment Committee, I tried to very concisely think about what kind of issues that this committee would be interested in. Biodiesel is, first of all, with regard to greenhouse gases, is one of the great advantages that we feel we have with it. It's the only advanced biofuel in the nation that's commercially available. It's recognized as a 50% or more reduction in greenhouse gases. Secondly, there's a number of air emission reductions, and the American Lung Association is here. They might be able to cover that a little further. Thirdly, energy ratios are something that I think this committee would be interested in. It has a 5.54-1 energy ratio. We get 5.54 as much energy out of it as is used to produce it. So a very high energy ratio. Air attainment, the clean air dialogue this past year, and American Lung could speak to that as well in support of biodiesel usage. One of the questions that comes up to me from time to time is water usage. People kind of confuse this with ethanol sometimes. In terms of ethanol, there is water used in the distillation process, but in biodiesel, there is no distillation process, and so the water usage is almost zero. The last thing I was going to say was when you take a look at one of the other issues that's sometimes raised to me is kind of the food versus fuel issue. And in this case, that's really not a very relevant issue because of the fact that the primary use of soybean crush or soybeans is for the 44% protein that they get from the soybeans. And to give you an example, out of a 60-pound bushel of soybeans, 47 pounds result in a food source, which is a 44% protein. In addition to that, there's about 10 to 11 pounds of oil that comes out of it, which is a byproduct and is not in short supply, so it's not really a food issue. And the last part of that point of that is that we used to use a lot of soybean oil, for instance, in fryers like McDonald's and so forth, but because of the trans fat issue, that has pretty much gone by the wayside, and so there's been a glut of oil because of that, and that's what this is used for, biodiesel.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Schoenfeld? Mr. Hunter, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, my name is John Hunter. I'm with the American Lung Association in Minnesota. I just want to speak very briefly about the environmental and air quality benefits that come with using biodiesel in Minnesota. The existing biodiesel law and the summer's progress to B10 will prove very important, I think, for health benefits. Biodiesel burns significantly cleaner than traditional petroleum diesel fuel, especially in older vehicles that haven't been retrofitted with any kind of particulate filter or anything like that. The diesel combustion contains a number of different pollutants of concern, and the vehicles are one of the largest sources of air pollution in Minnesota. So diesel vehicles contribute to our state's level of fine particulates, as well as ozone precursors. And the resulting health impacts for that include asthma attacks, difficulty breathing, increased susceptibility to respiratory illness, permanent lung damage, stroke, heart disease, and even premature death. And even sort of momentary effects can have sort of lasting repercussions. For example, asthma attacks are a leading medical reason for missed school. Which obviously impacts both a child's education, but also the parent who is going to be less productive at work, having to attend to their child. It's also worth mentioning that the World Health Organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer declared this last October that fine particulate matter is carcinogenic. Diesel engines are well built. They have the potential to run for decades. The quickest and easiest way to reduce pollution from these engines is with cleaner fuel, biodiesel. Working with the National Biodiesel Board, we put together the chart that I believe Mr. Schoenfeld had included in your packet demonstrating some of the additional air quality benefits that come from B10 use in the warmer months in Minnesota. I will preface that with saying that that chart was put together on the assumption of April through October, so that the switch to April through September would have a slight little bit of impact on that chart. But as you can see, it does demonstrate the added benefits of B10 being 65 tons of particulate pollution reductions, 85 tons of hydrocarbons, and greenhouse gas emission reductions of 275,000 tons each year. Quickly, I also mentioned the sort of economic repercussions of our air pollution in Minnesota. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency calculated recently that the particulate matter premature deaths has an economic impact of about $14 billion in Minnesota. And the health impacts that would come from asthma attacks and hospital visits, those kind of things of our air pollution, are about $149 million. And as mentioned, we are sort of borderline of non-attainment under the Clean Air Act for both particulates and ozone in Minnesota. We're sort of just under the threshold right now. The Clean Air Dialogues was a public-private partnership that worked together over the last couple of years to really look at what we can do to avoid going into non-attainment under the Clean Air Act. And as part of that, they recognized the B20 law as being very important for reducing our air pollution, but they also recognized that the economic costs, largely to businesses and individual citizens in Minnesota, for going into non-attainment would likely be in the $140 to $260 million range to try to get us back into the good graces of the Clean Air Act and to get to a healthy level of air. And there can also be some economic advantages to the users as well. I just want to highlight that Metro Transit used B20 over the summer months in their buses. They're the state's largest diesel user in the state, and they used biodiesel at 20% blends over the summer for one reason, and that was because it was cheaper for them, and they saved a lot of money. So they saved public dollars, and Minnesota residents got cleaner air. And with that, I will conclude.
Thank you. Senator Sparks, this bill, now you had, there were several soy biodiesel bills that you've been dealing with, and this is the compromise that you're pulling together right now.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We continue to have discussion, obviously, with the Minnesota Truckers Association, the auto dealers, but in a short session, I believe this was a pretty good compromise that we were able to come up with, and we'll continue to work with those organizations moving forward.
Do members of the committee have any questions, discussion, whatever? We can't act on it because the bill is not in front of us technically.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Schoenfeld, where are the three manufacturing plants?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosen, the one is in Brewster, Minnesota, at about a 35-million-gallon plant. There's about a 35-million-gallon plant that has just had a $55 million retrofit in Albert Lea, and then there's a third plant that is much smaller. They have a different process and a very use alternative feedstocks of about 3 to 5 million that's in Isanti.
Further discussion? If not, thank you for bringing it to the committee, even though we didn't have a chance to vote on it because of the process. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you for putting us into your schedule.
Senator Dibble's bill is next. Senator Dibble, welcome. Senate File 2819.
So thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 2819 is a Green Jobs Deconstruction Program proposal, which has a number of interesting goals that complement each other very well. Deconstruction, as you probably can intuit, is what we would do with a building in lieu of demolishing it. And, of course, what that means is we would take the building apart more deliberately rather than just knocking it down and hauling all the material off to the landfill. That would be, of course, environmentally much more desirable. What this bill proposes to do is to really develop and try to bring to scale an initial program which would allow for folks to get good entry-level jobs, folks who have been faced with challenges in their lives, folks who are looking to get back into the work world and gain some basic skills that they could build upon and perhaps even move on from there into the construction industry or other jobs. So we would create entry-level jobs that are a great starting point, reduce greenhouse gases and reliance on landfills, and also really try hard to establish a marketplace for these materials. I've misplaced my little fact sheet, but here it is. I have a new one. Some compelling factoids. The U.S. EPA estimates that, and this is from a study from the American Institute of Architects, that 40% of our solid waste that ends up in landfills is building waste. It's only second behind residential municipal solid waste. That we can, from a typical 2,000 square foot wood frame home, yield 6,000 board feet of reusable lumber. And you'll see some of the examples. This is really, really good lumber from old growth trees and has lots of reuse potentials. We know, of course, from our work in the past, the Minnesota Climate Change Action Group, that we talk a lot about the climate issues that come from the energy sector, but that's only one sector. We have a lot of CO2 and other similar climate-affecting emissions that result from how we handle our solid waste. So, Mr. Chair, members, I have a few folks here who can share with you more details about the bill. It's pretty straightforward, sets up the purpose, sets up a partnership under the auspices of the PCA, has a series of six goals around safe and cost-effective techniques for the deconstruction work, a training regimen, developing these sustainable markets for the reusable materials, finding and employing chronically unemployed adults, and then prepare a model policy for local units to take up and adopt, and then analyze whether or not we've been successful, with some direction to the PCA to monitor and report on the outcomes, and then an appropriation to get all of this going. So with that, Mr. Chair, we have Steve Thomas from Better Futures who would like to kick us off.
Mr. Thomas, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name's Steve Thomas. I'm the president and CEO of Better Futures Minnesota. And with our partner, the Northwest Indian OIC, we respectfully ask that you consider this bill. We are about creating opportunities in the marketplace. And by identifying and creating those opportunities, we're able to not only benefit the environment, but to create jobs for people who need them. And we want to provide pathways to better jobs. The waste recycling reuse arena is really underdeveloped. And as Senator Dibble just cited, we have a lot of waste being buried in landfills, not just lumber, but as you'll see in a moment, porcelain, lots of fixtures, cabinetry, doors, trim, and our intent, and with the assistance of the appropriation requested in this bill, with the Northwest Indian OIC, we would develop statewide not only deconstruction as a sustainable, financially sustainable practice, but the environmental benefits would be significant. So we'd be reclaiming lives. We'd be reusing these materials by selling them primarily through an online internet store. And as you'll see in a moment, we will use some of these materials as raw goods to produce new goods and new materials. And just lastly, this is not just some pipe dream. This is nationwide. Deconstruction is becoming more and more of a common practice, and in some communities, even a mandated practice. It creates five more times more jobs when we do this process, along with a significant impact on the reduction of greenhouse gases. I'll ask my colleague Nancy Hilden to briefly represent our partner, Northwest Indian OIC.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regrets, Talia Palmer just had to go back to Bemidji, where she runs the Northwest Indian OIC, so I'm just going to make a brief statement on her behalf. And thank you again for taking time. So the Northwest Indian OIC provides comprehensive and culturally specific workforce development programming. They've done so for about 25 years. They are the only provider of these types of services in North Central Minnesota. Last year, the organization served 1,256 people, of which 1,004 were Native American. They provided training in partnership with MNSCU and other regional employers. They are located in Bemidji, the metropolis of Bemidji, and serve the 50-mile radius, which includes Red Lake Nation, Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, and the White Earth Band of Ojibwe. This home, or this area, this region is home to more than 50% of Minnesota's American Indian population, and the reservations that I mentioned are the three economically poorest in the state. The unemployment rate fluctuates between twice the state average and up to 66% in some communities. These folks need jobs. In addition, and kind of a corollary to that is that Beltrami County has the highest felony incarceration rate per capita and highest rate of recidivism in the state. In this project, Northwest Indian OIC will partner with Better Futures and be the rural component to try to develop deconstruction as a viable endeavor in rural areas, not just the metro, and establish relationships with potential buyers of reclaimed materials, such as the Indian Housing Authority, which Talia pointed out that there is a waiting list for housing on just in that area alone of over 600 families in need of housing. Finally, this is a public health intervention. Work itself is a public health intervention to create jobs, to employ men and women, helps them stabilize, and you've heard how this works in other years too from Mr. Thomas, that giving someone a job changes many, many things in their life. And so this is a wonderful way to turn lives around as well as improve the environment. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. If with your indulgence, we have two more folks who'd like to share some thoughts briefly. We have Brian Brayshaw from the Natural Resources Research Institute, University of Minnesota, Duluth, and then we'll hear from Lante Morris, who works with Better Futures himself.
Mr. Brayshaw, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Brayshaw. I'm a research team leader at the University of Minnesota, Duluth's Natural Resources Research Institute. Our mission is to sustain economic development of Minnesota's natural resources in an environmentally sound manner. And typically, we work with raw materials from harvest or mining. But in this case, we become more increasingly involved in deconstruction and recycling and developing product applications as such. We are in the midst of a small product development project in cooperation with Better Futures Minnesota, a small $25,000 investment that's allowed us to try to help and work with them to identify what kinds of product applications can really come from deconstructed buildings. Now, we think about deconstruction, we have a couple of core materials, one of those being wood. We also have things like ceramics, and then we have all the rest of the materials that are in the houses, oftentimes glass, appliances, and other kinds of things. So if I could get the page to pass a few samples around, I'd appreciate that very much. So we're talking about high-grade Douglas fir, typically from older homes that's being constructed. Douglas fir has a very high resale market, but it needs to be usually repurposed in a variety of applications. So these kinds of things, like Douglas fir, can be are desired by the architectural community as vintage products. So we're talking about remanufacturing and value added for things like flooring, for furniture surfaces, for countertops, for desks, and for tables. So again, these are the kinds of things that can be deconstructed. Typically, deconstructed lumber is not used to rebuild homes. It's used in a value-added application. But there's other things in the building, too. Like, this would be typically the backside, which shows the evidence and history of tar paper over time. So this is prior to OSB and plywood as a building sheathing material. And by flipping it around and going the other direction, we now have the ability to create flooring applications of, again, vintage reutilized materials in the United States. So if you pass this one, maybe not that one. Ceramics, things like sinks, things like toilets. Again, this material can be reprocessed and reground and potentially dye-added for landscape applications. Again, a variety of things. Historically, that's a product that has never been reutilized as ceramic materials. Appliances. Appliances are one of those things that we tend not to think about. They go to recycling centers or landfills. They're crushed in large form. But by deconstructing appliances, for instance, this happens to be a compressor motor. This compressor motor by itself is worth about 30 cents on the recycling market, or about $30 to $40 per ton. But by simply developing a process to take the top off and pull the copper out, we have about $3 or $4, $5 worth of copper that comes out of this material. So instead of 30 cents, we're now worth about $3 to $4. So $30 a ton up to $600 a ton. So again, those are kinds of things that have application and can move forward. And finally, books. There is a market for recycling paper that is in books that are undesired. But one of the things that we need to do is come up with applications for the bindings, because recycling centers don't want the bindings. So simply dipped in paraffin, we now have a fire starter opportunity to reclaim. So I think these are just some ideas that have been moved forward in a very simple way. The opportunity through this bill and through additional funding. But through this program, we'll have the opportunity to fully explore and identify exactly how to get these products into the market, because, again, it's going to require additional resources, equipment, and investment that's going to help move forward to really bring these applications to market. It wasn't all that long ago that we just thought about putting everything in. Only 5 years ago, one of our big success stories has been mattress recycling. Only 5 years ago, almost all mattresses in Minnesota went into the landfill. Now they're being deconstructed by organizations like PPL and Goodwill. And I can definitely see Better Futures Minnesota really moving forward in building deconstruction through the pass of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we have Lante Morris.
Mr. Morris, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm Lante Morris. I represent the men on behalf of Better Futures who will be employed through this bill being passed. To help create more jobs and help bring people closer, like it'll get us away from like falling to our old behaviors, and it'll get us more involved in the community and open up more jobs for people who are entry level coming from prison and things like that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we have a number of folks here with us from Better Futures if they want to stand or raise their hands.
Thank you for being here. And like Mr. Morris, you are in the program at Better Futures. You're learning how to take apart everything, I guess. Thank you. Is there Senator Brown?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dibble, I just have a suggestion that under the goals, specifically on 2.5 and 2.6, where we're talking about creating jobs, that maybe we make it a goal that these jobs are required to receive a prevailing wage or a livable wage. Just a suggestion.
Mr. Chair, I'm not necessarily opposed to that. I, of course, would need to talk to my
folks. If I can just comment, that's a very interesting question, Mr. Chair, Nancy Hilden. So one of the things that is a dilemma even right now is the difference in price between demolition and deconstruction. And the cost to just rip something down and truck it all to the landfill, cheap, easy, quick. And one of the barriers to getting people to do deconstruction instead is the amount of time and the higher cost. So I think nobody is arguing to find ways to do prevailing wage and living wage on this. Certainly not us, but just understand that the barriers, as you add to the costs on that side, are pushing against what exists now, which is very cheap. So just a comment. I think it's friendly, but it will make it even harder to get this thing started.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we share that value. I mean, we're committed to paying our starting workers, which are also getting a $300 a month housing subsidy, $9.50 an hour. So we're trying to reflect the new proposed minimum wage. And then our trained workers, like Mr. Morris, who have been credentialed. They've had OSHA training, they would start at $12 an hour and earn up to $14. That's about what we can get in the marketplace right now, because we're mostly dealing with private developers who, as Ms. Hilden just said, their alternative is demolition. So that's been our economic model. And obviously, if we can improve sales and generate income from other sources, that enables us to increase wages. But that's the economic model that we've been trying to build out now.
Further, is there anybody else? Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just would like to applaud the group that's working on this proposal, because anybody who's done any reconstruction or deconstruction, it's pretty sad to see all of this good material go to the landfill when you feel like you're part of the process that's wasting energy. And I think that this is a win-win situation. So thanks to you for working on this.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We seem to have carved out two entities. Is there only two entities, or would this be a competitive grant process? I guess I'd like to have some understanding. We're looking at handing over $2 million for a grant process. If there's sort of a predetermined outcome, I think we should be transparent about that.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, yes, you know, of course, these are the folks who are bringing forward the initiative and the idea. I'm guessing that, you know, and we're trying to bring it to scale, of course, and, you know, they may not be able to handle all of this work as this really starts to take off. But Nancy Hilden had a...
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, so... has already had experience with about six or more houses. They have the partnership with NRI already. And in looking for a way to apply this and build it up in a rural area, and especially an area that is in such need, it seemed very appropriate to identify a rural partner that does this kind of training and pathway building. So you're right, it is specific, but there's justification for that.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Senator Benson, also, though, there's no one doing this now, and our hope and one of the goals is to produce some policies that incentivize, and I would hope over time we would have competition that for this to be statewide, both on not only the process of deconstruction, but on the sale of materials. And you see that in some other places. I mean, one of our models is out in Berkeley, and it's a private enterprise on a 3-acre lot. But there's a lot of incentives and policies in California that facilitate that business. So our hope is that we can build a robust marketplace beyond just our involvement.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Dibble.
To Mr. Thomas's point, I'll just draw the committee's attention to line 2.7. To look at model policies for, you know, like I said earlier, bringing an idea like this to scale. You know, so this is just a start. And, of course, these are the folks with the idea working in conjunction with the university and the agency.
Further discussion? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at $2 million, and I don't have any financial information. We're being really specific. Not setting it up for a competitive grant. I'm just feeling really uncomfortable that we're taking $2 million and handing it to an entity. This committee doesn't, and I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but who's looked at the financials to say this is the best next best use of $2 million? And that's my challenge right now. Because we don't give discretion to the department to do sort of a financial analysis prior to letting the grant.
Senator Eaton.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, doesn't this go to Senator Tomasoni's committee?
Senator Eaton, it does, and I was going to say I think Senator Benson's points are something that needs to be looked at.
Because right.
I think both the dollar amount and also whether it is competitive or not, I think.
Right, and I would think that would be addressed
My feeling is I don't want this. I mean, you can amend it any way you want. I'm just saying that I think that those are questions. Your questions are exactly what we have to, what that committee, and we're welcome to talk about it all here, obviously. But I'm not on that committee, but I hope that committee is doing what you're saying.
Yeah, I apologize. I spent a lot of time in finance this morning. So,
Senator Benson, it's not inappropriate to talk about here. It's just that's where it has to be talked about. Is there further discussion? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have been a big fan of the Better Futures for a long time. But my question is on the appropriation, too. I'm sorry. But the $2 million, and if it's just geared towards the commissioner of the PCA has to calculate the amount of carbon emissions reduced by the deconstruction for $250,000. And the Department of Economic Deed gets $2 million to collection of the jobs created. I'd just rather Yeah. I'd rather just see a program started and they could develop a program and see it expand and not have to collect all the information. And I mean, obviously you found a niche here that is appropriate, and hopefully you can create jobs going forward with this. It just seems like we're giving a lot to these departments that I'm just a little confused on the outcomes here.
So, Senator Rosen, you're specifically talking about item B under appropriations that that would fund the activities under item number 6 and also subdivision 5.
Right.
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 Well, I think our goal is part of our goal is to make sure we're doing a good job, because if in fact this is successful, in order to fulfill item number 5, we really need to know what those measures are, how we define success, and be able to replicate that. And so $250,000 may be too much money. We can figure that out in financing conversation with the PCA. Maybe it's not enough, but it's a lot of money. but I think doing the evaluation piece, capturing that information, getting these folks going, but making sure we're on the back end evaluating, measuring, quantifying, replicating, would be important, because our housing stock isn't going to last forever. Houses are going to will continue to come down and be replaced, and it'd be great if, rather than just knocking them down and hauling them off, we can do some of this work. It would be incredible. It would be amazing.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, Senator Dibble, I'm trying to get my head around it. I guess I'd rather see the money just going towards the bricks and mortars of the program itself and not collection of data and see if, how much carbon emissions are going to be reduced. We obviously know this is a really great project that you can get your hands around and grow. That's all. I'm just rather seeing the success of the program with an investment like this instead of arbitrary or right. documentation of carbon emissions. We know there's going to be carbon emissions, but
right.
that's very hard to document.
And I'd also say that if we are putting money in for evaluation, that I was going to say carbon emission may be one part of it. I'd say a bigger impact would be on landfill reduction and other things the recycling of the copper is hugely valuable. I think I would argue that your outcomes should be reworked a little bit more, because carbon emissions might be one part of it. But, I'm not one, and I don't know if Senator Benson, you may not be on the budget division as well, but I hope that one, the dollar amounts are looked at, and in terms of the outcomes from the agency, whether that's the right thing that they're looking at. I'm not sure that you got one narrow focused item there that you're looking at, and I think that's important, but it's one of several outcomes you might look at. Senator Benson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dibble, actually, I'm going to move line 2.13, subdivision 5, to delete section A. Frankly, I don't think carbon emissions are the priority of the program. I think they're a good outcome. But I think the priority is the people who are employed, and then we'd have to renumber the subsequent section. I think it's the employment, the movement of participants from unemployed yes. to clearly employable. And, if we want to work on creating another report from the Pollution Control Agency, I just think there's probably better use of our dollars. So if I could move that, Mr. Chair.
Sarah Benson moves to delete paragraph A on lines 13 through 16 of page 2.
Mr. Chair, I would speak against the motion. I don't think it is onerous, and I think it is useful to have both the environmental as well as the social benefits make us aware. It is a good thing, and I don't think I think it's fairly straightforward. We have some pretty straightforward metrics around if we're able to avoid landfilling, if we're able to avoid and be able to do recycling. Those aren't like difficult calculations to make, so it would be interesting and important and useful information for us. It does no harm to know these things.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I think that as you go forward, you're going to get more items added, carbon emissions items recycled, landfill avoided, and the PCA is going to give you a good-sized fiscal note that I think could probably better be spent somewhere else, is my concern.
I wanted to speak one thing related to the amendment. Senator Dibble, I think you summarized what I think you – what I'm guessing you may have intended paragraph A to be, which it is not, and that is that somebody ought to be looking at the environmental impacts instead of listing one environmental impact of it. And I agree with you. We ought to look at that. I think you've got one item listed there, and I think you just might just have a PC, Commissioner PCA shall monitor outcomes, including information related to the environmental impacts. But I'm not trying to rework that now. I'm just saying that I think what you described, why you want the paragraph there, is different than what the paragraph says. So I think your paragraph is much narrower. But
very, very fair, Mr. Chair. Of course, then you would be speaking and you would be kind of
speaking
supporting Senator Benson's argument here.
Somewhere in between. Is there further discussion of Senator Benson's amendment? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion does not prevail.
But, Mr. Chair, I do want to let Senator Benson and Senator Rosa know that I actually agree we shouldn't be developing a huge bureaucratic undertaking that's going to cost a bunch of money that's going to detract from what we're trying to accomplish. So I will take your advice and counsel with me to on the way to Senate Finance, as well as yours, Senator Marty, although you're trying to spend more money.
on the bureaucratic stuff. Senator Dibble, I was not asking for spending $250,000. And I know that that money is for incentives and community outreach, but I'm not sure if that's the way I put $250,000 to doing that. My only point was just suggesting that the same way you're asking Deed to look at the outcomes in terms of jobs and so on, I was going to suggest, and you don't have an appropriation for them, I was going to say a minimal appropriation to the PCA to take a look at the environmental outcomes and whether they need the $250,000 for incentives and to develop incentives in a market. I'm not sure that's appropriate, and I think about half of this committee serves on Senator Tomasoni's division, right, and I hope all of you who are on that are looking at that.
Right. Well, Mr. Chair, we'll try to get it right. So try to get it just the right equilibrium of making sure we have some way to evaluate what we're doing, but not creating a big bureaucratic effort and spending a lot of money.
Senator Brown, then Senator
that.
Rosen. Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dibble, I'm really struggling with the jobs part of this. I could support this bill if we would do better than minimum wage. And I would really like to see a goal in here for at least a livable wage. I don't know who we're really helping creating more minimum wage jobs. If we're going to really make some goals and do something to help the chronically unemployed adults, I'd like to think we could do better than minimum wage. And I would love to see a goal put in here where we say something to the effect of at least a livable wage. I'm not sure how we're helping these folks, just creating more minimum wage jobs.
So,
and I would support you if we did that.
All right.
That alone is worth something.
But there have been a few Dibble Brown pairings that happened. Senator Brown, you know, I'd be welcome to either entertain a motion right now or work with you to develop some language on the way to finance.
Senator Brown, your choice.
Could I get help from counsel to amend line 2.6 that would include language to say these jobs would to paid a livable wage, and I don't know if there's a standard for livable. I don't know if that's the right word. To me, livable is considerably more than minimum.
Let's see, between...
Mr. While you and Senate Council work on that, Senator Rosen had a comment
or question.
Oh,
Senator, I have a suggestion. Maybe you could,
for
Mr. Fuller, could we just stick the word create living wage jobs on line 2.5, insert the words living wage before jobs.
Senator Brown?
That works.
Senator Brown moves.
Thank you.
Insert living wage on page 2, line 5, after the word create. Is there a discussion of that amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Rosen, you had...
Yes, I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think you're onto something here, Senator Dibble. I think this is, a niche program here that you could really expand on. Sustainable job program, whatever you want, job creation. So again, I'm just a little confused in the 2.8. I mean, the main purpose of the program to me is still in creating jobs, sustainable jobs, tracking if there's job creations outside of this program. I mean, it's a little vague as far as are these gentlemen just going to continue working in this capacity, or is there going to be jobs created ongoing thereafter? I hope we track this ongoing as far as the job itself. I know there's going to be wonderful environmental aspects to it, but the program itself needs to be pumped up.
Mr. Chair, if I may, and Senator Rosen, we have a pretty robust business plan for this where we know we would create a crew chief job, which pays in the mid-30s. There'd be four full-time jobs among the men. That's 12 to 14 an hour. And the $950 an hour jobs I mentioned, those are part-time, short-term kind of training. You got to prove yourself. And then you move into the 12 and 14. And then there's three ways you could go. One, you keep working with us and maybe move up into crew chief or other roles. We want our contracting partners to hire our men, and those are often union jobs. And then three, we've been talking to the trades about referring some men for apprenticeship opportunities. So when you're in this market, you have relationships. We're working with about 30 different contractors now, and we see ourselves. We're already getting demand. Our workforce is being developed as a skilled workforce, and that they're ready to hire. So those are the three options we expect to maintain once we get this to a level of sustainability.
Okay,
Senator Herr.
Mr. Chair, looks like everybody in the room have made a very good comment, and I appreciate Senator Brown for inserting that part in there and that living wage in there. And I know people have concern about the $2 million. That's a lot of money, but if you think about the number of entity are involved, that may not seem to be a lot of money for that. And I'm glad that it's going to require, go to some evaluation, that we will look at the right dollar amount for it. And so I just want to put my remark on in support of this bill.
Thank you, Senator Herr. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If there's nothing further, I would move Senate File 2819 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Senator Dibble moves. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Congratulations. Senator Dibble, Senate File 2819. Welcome back.
And we just
I think Senate File 2049.
We just did 2819. 2049. I stand corrected. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to offer the A11 amendment, please.
Members, the A11 amendment. Thank you. A11, is it in your packet? Senator Dibble moves the A11 amendment. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 2049, it had four parts, now it has two parts. And so I'll just give a very high-level description of what those are. And then I've got two fellows here who can give you more details. So what this seeks to accomplish, Mr. Chair and members, is in the first part, Section 1 now, establish an on-bill repayment program so that customers of utilities can pay off their loan, a loan that they might have received for an energy efficiency project on their home or on their business, whether that's some sort of an efficiency project or some sort of distributed renewable energy project. And it establishes the kind of the rules and the terms. It's purely voluntary by the utilities. Make sure that these loans are being made by qualified lenders, and the criteria for the qualified lenders is set forth. Making sure that there's opportunities for the utility to take over those loans if they so desire, but not to necessarily keep bad loans so that other ratepayers are exposed. Making sure that customers that the loan itself stays with the customer and not with the property or the bill. Although there's an amendment coming later that in which that's going to be construed a little bit differently for a different purpose. Make sure that there's full and fair access to the ability to pay off these loans on your utility bill if in a non-discriminatory fashion, so any qualified lender who's financing these. This is, of course, for the energy efficiency, energy conservation projects, definitely available for those initiatives and efforts that utilities are supporting through their SIP programs. More details like that are set forth that Mr. Bull can help you with. The second, or Mr. Straw, you're going to talk about this piece?
Sure.
All right. And then the second piece is just simply extends, if you will, the time horizons for the integrated resource planning, just kind of extending beyond the 15-year horizon, just some having utilities share some thoughts with the commission. And with the commission or with the agency? With the commission on how they're thinking about providing for resources into the distant future, generation resources, getting past the point at which, for example, the nuclear power plants are going to be expiring, permits are going to be expiring and possibly be decommissioned. So that's the broad brush, very high-level outline. And I have Sheldon Strom here from Center for Energy and Environment, as well as Mike Bull from the same, and they have some more details I'd like to share with you.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Mr. Bull, you want to go for you first?
Thank you.
Mr. Bull, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Mike Bull. I'm the policy director at the Center for Energy and Environment, and with me is Sheldon Strom, who's our president. And I think Senator Dibble gave a great overview of the bill. As he mentioned, as initially introduced, the bill had four components, and we've worked with and incorporated recommendations from a broad cross-section of stakeholders on those initiatives, including the environmental community, the Minnesota Rural Electric Association, the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association, the Chamber of Commerce, Otter Tail, Great River, XL, CenterPoint. So a broad, as well as the folks from staff from the Public Utilities Commission, and staff from the Department of Commerce. So we've incorporated all of these thoughts, and we appreciate everyone's willingness to work with us on these initiatives. She's not here for me to call her out, but I do want to thank Annette Henkel from the Minnesota Utilities Investors Association. She did a great job in pulling us all together to work through a number of these issues very efficiently and productively, and we appreciate that. So we were able to find broad consensus with that broad set of stakeholders on two of the provisions and not so on the other two. So after talking with Senator Dibble, we've dropped the other two and moving forward with the ones that we do have a sort of peace in the valley on. So I'll talk about the Sheldon will talk about the on-bill repayment framework, and then I'll take over and talk about the long-range emissions reduction stuff.
Okay. I'm Sheldon Strom with the Center for Energy and Environment. I think Senator Dibble covered the high spots on on-bill repayment. Just a few comments. On-bill repayment for energy loans is not a new idea. We actually did it in the 80s with Minnegasco, and the city of Minneapolis sold tax-exempt bonds, and Minnegasco offered those loans to their customers, and that worked really well at that time. It was probably the first program of its kind in the country. But that was a different time. Gas prices at that time, adjusted for inflation, were relatively high. There was very little insulation in homes, so the energy opportunities were very easy to find. And there were really no other alternatives to financing. So now it's a little different time, but we still think that maybe an on-bill repayment program carefully designed can add additional energy savings opportunities for utilities. NSP also did an on-bill repayment program that ended in the 90s. And as we've talked to utilities about this over the years, one of the problems that they faced was ambiguity about whether a customer who pays part of their bill should assign those payments to the bill, the utility bill, or to their loan. That wasn't really resolved. It turned out to be quite a problem for Xcel. Same thing with with customers who didn't pay their bills. What happened, as I understand it, is quite a big balance of unpaid bills and other problems were left for Xcel and the PUC to deal with. And so as we've talked to utilities about on-bill repayment over the last few years, one of the things they're saying is we want to have clarity to how we do this. We don't want to face that circumstance again. So all this bill does, it's permissive. It simply says that if a utility submits an on-bill repayment plan for approval by the department, it's got to be focused on energy conservation. It's got to protect non-participating ratepayers. In other words, the lender who provides the funding has to take responsibility for providing good loans and has to take responsibility for defaults. It's also clear that that if a customer pays only part of their bill, that's contributed to their utility bill, not their loan. And the reason this is important is that there are some people around the country are trying to advocate for passing on the cost of these loans to other ratepayers. And if you provide financing and if the people don't have to pay back the loan, it's, of course, easy to provide the financing, but then somebody else has to pay back the loan. And there are others who think that if somebody doesn't pay back their loan, you should be able to shut off their electric service. Just seems to us that that's not a Minnesota way to do stuff. So all this bill does, it's permissive. It sets out these protections for the non-participating ratepayers and just provides some clarity.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Mr. Bull, are there any questions for the first two folks? Mr. Bull?
Mr. Chair, I thought I'd maybe talk a little bit about the emissions reduction planning section of the bill, just to give a highlight on the second section.
Section two.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Section two, folks. Mr. Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the second section is one we've been working on with Wind on the Wires, and it asks utilities as part of their resource planning to look at their systems and describe the costs and opportunities and technical barriers the utility expects with regard to continuing to make progress on carbon emissions. And what alternatives the utilities are considering to address those challenges. We're not proposing, and it's important to know that we're not proposing a requirement that utilities do reduce their emissions. All of our utilities are and will continue to reduce their emissions in the near term. It's looking out beyond the 5 and 15-year planning horizon for current resource planning to get a sense from the utilities where their challenges are going to be on their systems going forward. Ultimately the idea is to have an honest conversation about carbon emissions and emissions planning generally, starting
sooner rather than later, so that when these decisions come into the 5 and 15 year planning horizon, where the commission needs to make decisions about actions the utility wants to make, we've had some public discussion about these things. You know, we've had long lead time for planning these alternatives. Do they need more transmission? Do they want to think about more Canadian Hydro? What are the alternatives utilities want to be thinking about? And so by the time it gets into that 5 and 15 year planning horizon, the commission will have had some discussion about those alternatives. I do want to thank the utilities for working really hard with us in good faith to craft the language on this provision. XL, Minnesota Power, Otter Tail, Great River, and others. I think we sat down and had a really good process on both of these provisions, and we appreciate the time and attention they've all given us. And I think it's a good process that we'll want to use going forward to see where we can work out the various concerns that a broad group of stakeholders have.
Thank you, Mr. Bull. Senator Brown.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bull, I do have a question on that. I had read a report recently that we're not on track to meet our goal for 2015. I'm just wondering, are we on schedule for achieving the state greenhouse gas goals that we put into place, or are we behind on that?
Mr. Bull.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, we are ahead of the goal for the utility sector. We're not going to make the 2015 goal for the broad economy goal, but that's not the fault or the responsibility of the utilities. It's everything else that's part of the economy that we haven't been able to figure out. We continue to look at for good policies and technologies that will help us in the rest of the economy. But the utilities are making great progress on their greenhouse gas goals.
Senator Brown, follow-up? No, thank you.
Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Dibble?
If we pass my last bill, we'll get on track.
Senator Dibble, you have Joe Sullivan and Joel Johnson here as well. Joe from Wind on Wires and Joel from the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. Come on down. Who's going first?
Well, Joel probably has something dire to say, so maybe I should let him go first.
Welcome, Joel.
Thank you, Johnson. Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name's Joel Johnson. I'm with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association, which is the association of all the electric co-ops in the state. And actually, I'm here to testify in favor of the bill. And excuse me. First off, I want to commend the author and the Center for Energy and Environment for the process they set up to pass this bill. We first spoke with CEE back in the summer, and we've had a number of meetings with them throughout the process. They listened patiently to our concerns. They addressed the need for flexibility within our really diverse membership, and I think we ended up with a bill that we can support. We didn't get everything we wanted in it. We still have concerns that the IRP process, we think the state definitely needs to have a broader conversation about the cost of and how we're going to meet our greenhouse gas goals going into the future. We're not certain that the IRP is the best process for that, but they worked with us on language that gave us enough comfort that we can go ahead and support this, and also gave us enough confidence that I think we can have a really productive conversation about the way that we go about it. So I urge the members of the committee to vote in favor of the bill. And again, I hope this becomes a model for putting together legislation going forward for all of the stakeholders. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. There is one other person, too, that needs to come up, Chris Dufferin. But as Joel, Mr. Sullivan, go ahead, and then we'll get Mr. Dufferin to come up as well. And then if you would stand for questions afterwards. Sure. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Sullivan, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Joe Sullivan. I'm the regional policy manager for Wind on the Wires. And first of all, I would like to reiterate the comments that have been said here already. I think that, you know, this has been a very good way to put together a bill, and I commend Senator Dibble and CEE for how they've gone about doing it. You know, my comments will be very brief, but really why Wind on the Wire supports this and why we worked with Mike and CEE in preparing the legislation is because, you know, from our perspective, we think that we really need to get behind, you know, some of the, you know, there have been a lot of studies that have been proposed and are being worked on right now. We really need to get behind that and say, what are the fundamental drivers that are happening in the electric system? And when we talk about these, you know, people are always saying, well, 15 years from now, 20 years from now, 25 years from now. And we think that this is a great forum through the resource planning process or potentially, you know, in other formal processes to say, well, let's start talking about, you know, what are flat sales going to do? What are an aging, you know, fleet of, you know, large generators going to mean for the electric system? So we think that this is a really important way to put context to the larger energy debate, and I strongly support the bill and thank the Senator Dibble and everybody for working on it and urge support of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Dufferin, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Chris Dufferin. I'm the director of the Neighborhood Energy Connection. We're a group in St. Paul that delivers energy efficiency programs and financing programs. So I want to just preface my support for this bill with one remark is that I'm not sure that on-bill repayment will have a huge effect on energy efficiency. You know, there's going to be instances where utilities are going to be better served probably working with other lending programs and local lenders, and financing isn't the only thing that drives energy efficiency. But with that said, I think on-bill repayment could be useful in certain situations for certain utilities and in certain sectors more than others. I also think there's utilities that may already be thinking about proposing such a measure. I don't think there's anything that in legislation that would prevent that. So for that reason, I think that Senator Dibble's bill does a good job of laying the groundwork and setting some rules for these kinds of arrangements. Mr. Strom mentioned most of them already, but I'll just quickly hit on three. One is that I think it is smart to make on-bill repayment optional. Not every utility and every sector, this might not make sense for them. But if utilities are interested in meeting their 1.5% goals, this could be a good option, and they should have that flexibility. Second is to clarify that the first payment goes for the provision of utility service, I think, is extremely important. And this bill really, in fact, clarifies that the risk is solely on the lender. And if we're going to have lenders in this market offering this kind of service, we want to make sure that they are the ones at risk and not ratepayers at risk. As Mr. Strom mentioned, there's several of these companies around the country, and their real goal is to push the risk onto ratepayers and take the risk off themselves. So I think that's a very good provision in this bill. And finally, just to ensure that we are not threatening anyone's access to utility service is extremely important, and that is laid out in the bill as well. There are those third-party financing groups that would like to use this as leverage, use the leverage of possible disconnection as a way to receive payment on the loan, which we don't think is a good way of doing business here in Minnesota. For any lender. So I commend all the protections that are in this bill. I think it's a really sound bill and will make on-bill repayment much safer, much fairer for ratepayers and for borrowers. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dufferin, your nonprofit does loans for a lot of low-income folks on this. Would you use a program like this if it's available? For on-bill repayment, or is it kind of wouldn't make sense for your situation?
Mr. Chair, we would use any program where the benefit was good. If the terms were good for the borrower and was putting them in a good situation that wasn't putting them at risk at default, and it was providing them with energy efficiency that they couldn't otherwise receive through some cheaper way, you know, we would support it. We do serve a lot of low-income customers with loan products, and some are going to be probably better than what could be provided on bill financing, and so we would encourage them to use those products instead. But there's gaps, and so having options out there, I think, makes a lot of sense.
Question, Senator Brown.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dibble, two questions. I'm not sure if it's in the bill or not, but for a property owner who sells their property, are there provisions in here that would require them to repay the loan by closing? And the second question would be, if you're renting and you get a loan, would you be able to get a loan longer than for the term of your rental lease?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do know that the loan would stay with the individual who takes out the loan, so they would have to either bring it with them or repay them. I don't know if there's a specific provision for repayment upon closing.
It doesn't require.
I think I could answer that, Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown. It would depend on the lenders that the utility had selected. So, for example, if the lender was offering or putting a second mortgage on the property, which you might do for large measures, then when the property was sold, typically that's paid off. If it's an unsecured loan, then that's just the creditworthiness of the borrower. So that would all depend upon what the lender came up with. And what we're trying to do here is just come up with a framework for how this could be done, and leave it up to a utility and individual lenders to decide what they want to do. I hope that answers your question.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator
Brown. So on line 2.18 of the A11, so that's paragraph H, speaks somewhat, but maybe not with precision, to your question, where it talks about an outstanding balance on a loan being repaid under the subdivision as a financial obligation only of the customer. This is a signatory to the loan and not to any subsequent customer occupying the property associated with the loan. And then it talks about if the public utility has purchased the loan from the lender has to take back the loan if the borrower moves. And then the repayment provision isn't spoken to specifically, but does that start to get to what you're curious about?
Yes, Senator Dimmel, Mr. Chair, I did see that. I just wasn't, I guess, quite clear to me on exactly what it was saying.
Yeah. Senator, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble, I raised my hand and you called me. I had the same question as Senator Brown on that, because that language isn't in effect. In this case, the utility that's doing on-bill repayment can put some other lender's loans on the bills, but they can also purchase the loans from the lender, and you're saying that in that case, if the borrower is moving out of the property, then they'd have to return the loan to the lender and so on. But in other words, it's up to that lender and the borrower whether they want to require in the terms of the loan to end it when they sell the property.
Mr. Chair, the answer to that question is, or series of questions, is yes. And some of the provisions for the utility's ability to purchase the loans are up a little bit further on, starting on lines 2.7. The public utility can purchase the loan from the lender under some conditions. In other words, they can dump the bad loans. They will only be servicing the current loans. Risk. The original lender retains the risk. Et cetera.
Thank you. Other questions? Does Department of Commerce have any questions, concerns about the bill they wanted to raise? Speak to the bill at all? Any of the utilities who haven't? Anybody have? Nobody seems to be coming forward. Is there any other discussion from members of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment to the bill, to the amendment.
Senator Dibble has an A. Is that, I'm told,
A12,
and is that,
yes,
in our packets, I believe. Okay. Senator Dibble moves the 812 amendment. I suppose this is, technically speaking, an author's amendment, or this is the first committee? I'm sorry,
yes.
I came in the middle of your bill.
Yes, it's an amendment to the author's amendment. I don't know, does that continue to be an author's amendment?
If you're presenting it as part of the bill, yes, but if you want to discuss it first, that's fine.
Mr. Chair, yeah, why don't we discuss it, and then I'll offer it. Mr. Chair, what this would accomplish is to extend the on-bill loan repayment to multifamily and commercial buildings under some conditions that would, of course, remain voluntary. It would be for energy efficiency improvements and can be included under the SIP program of the utility. Some of the provisions around if, in fact, tenants would be paying these loans, how that would occur with their permission in writing in those instances when and it would stay with the building in this instance or with the unit in the building, allow for that loan to be assumed either by the building owner if the unit is vacant or a successor tenant. And with that, I have a representative of Fresh Energy here.
Mr. Nissen, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Nissen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Will Nissen, Policy Associate at Fresh Energy. I want to thank Senator Dibble for offering this amendment. The intent of this amendment is to allow on-bill repayment to work in rental markets, in cases where a tenant pays a utility bill, but the landlord owns the building. In those cases, because the landowner has no tie to the utility bill, there is not a financial incentive to invest in energy efficiency in the unit. So this would open up a possibility of this mechanism working where a tenant would pay back the portion of the loan for their unit on their utility bill and kind of bridge that gap between the benefits to the building owner and the tenant. And I'm free to answer any questions you might have. Again, it is voluntary for all parties involved. The tenant must agree in writing. Building owners must be willing to participate, and utilities as well must have to be willing to participate.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Nissen? Now, Senator Dibble moved the A-12 amendment. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Is there further discussion on the bill? Anybody else who needed to speak to it?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to mention on this A-12 that just went on, we have a little bit more work to do just to make sure that tenants who agree to these loans and then successor tenants as well are receiving consideration. We're just clear about that. That's pretty a pretty important principle in tenant law, and also making sure that there's just full awareness, making sure that there's something in writing that's very clear and very legible so that tenants who are either entering into this agreement or taking over these agreements are just fully informed and fully aware.
Because the information is critical so people know what they're getting into, but also I think when I look at how inefficiency of appliances in some rental units and so on, it's a huge issue here.
Yeah, so I just want to make sure we button up the level of disclosure and clarity so that tenants are fully aware of these provisions.
Further discussion on the bill? Senator Benson.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Reading the A-2 amendment, so that language, I'm not sure I understand the mechanism. They're allowed to do on-bill repayment, and then so does the building owner also have to agree so that if the tenant defaults or leaves, then the building owner is willing to assume the liability.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, the answer to that question is yes.
Okay.
Further discussion? If not, Senator Dibble moves that Senate file 2049 as amended be recommended to pass, and I believe this goes to the Finance Committee. Further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Senator Huffman has one bill that I'm told is fairly brief. Senate File 2806.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 2806. With me today is Sia Herr, who is the director of the Council of Asian Pacific Minnesotans. A negative force, this invasive bighead silver and grass carp, is heading our way up the Mississippi River. As you know, there was one of the silvers that landed on top of the Winona Dam last year, and there was pictures that went all over. But we're going to spend millions of dollars attempting to keep these invasive carp from Minnesota streams, rivers, and lakes. We must be the stop to the invasive species. Our precious waterways, as you know, are at risk. It's true. In the 1970s, catfish farmers in mostly southern states began importing carp from China to help clean their commercial ponds. Their accumulation by the millions in the Mississippi River Basin became established during the floods of the 1990s. Word means a lot, and as we have all learned, oftentimes careless nicknames are used to perhaps simplify a name, perhaps make it easier to pronounce, or even to label something or someone. For the record, an issue I have had with many others are concerned about the labeling of the big-headed and silver carp as Asian carp. This destructive invasive species that we will spend millions to defeat has been given just a very careless nickname. And Minnesota has a growing Asian American community. These good people are among the newest of Minnesotans. They are friends or neighbors or colleagues, our constituents, and our relatives. Why would we voluntarily nickname an invasive species after a group of new and important citizens in a continent representing their homeland? Yes, I know it's been done before, and there are many examples. As we have learned in our state and from around the country, the careless nicknames are being challenged, but we don't have to do it again. Even this year, we've gotten rid of names like defective people and fixing defective people and mental hygiene from our records. So this is an attempt to really clean up. And as we begin changing this unfortunate nickname by making a commitment to the term Asian carp, it's not going to be part of Minnesota statute. It's not going to be in Minnesota. It is one statute at this point, and Senate File 2806 changes that. Senate File 2806 also instructs the Commissioner of Natural Resources that the term Asian carp may not be used in proposed law, rules, or official documents. And Mr. Chair, just to let you know that I've talked with, and Bob Meyer can't make it here, but I've spoken to the DNR and they have no objections. LCCMR is also going to start to make changes as well. And note that there is no fiscal note on this as well. So with the statement, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Ms. Herr.
Sir, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to come here before you. As Senator Huffman has already introduced me, I am Sia Herr, and I am the executive director of the State Advisory Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. As a representative of the council, I am here to speak in support of Senate File 2806. But before I go any further, let me just say a little bit more about our council. We seek to represent the most diverse community in Minnesota. Our community of Asian Pacific Islanders numbers at about 250,000 strong. We are the fastest growing ethnic group in the state of Minnesota and in the country. And some of our most recent arrivals are the Karen, the Hmong, the Vietnamese, so mainly the Southeast Asian refugee groups. Today I am here to share with you that we support Senate File 2806 for two very specific reasons. One is that the response to the species has been, and we believe will continue to be, overwhelmingly negative, and thus we feel reflects very negatively on our community of Asian Americans. Two, the term invasive carp would highlight the problem of this species, which is that it is invasive, not that it is Asian. We believe that whenever and wherever possible, we should create laws with language that effectively reflects our objectives and contributes to our collective effort to live up to the belief that out of many comes one. With that said, thank you so much for the opportunity. And again, we hope that you will hear where we are coming from and that you will include Senate File 2806 in your committee omnibus bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Herr. Ms. Lee, you wanted to testify as well. Welcome to the committee.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee.
a president and executive director of Children's Hope International, which does legal advocacy and public policy, art in our family centers that does shelters, transition and permanent housing and development services, and APAC, which is the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium of Trusted Housing Professionals and Service Providers. So we have come before this committee before because of our term and prior bills about 2 years ago related to Asian carp and how things kind of evolved. I also wanted to say, as far as the Asians in Minnesota, include very notable people like teachers, doctors, lawyers, engineers, and so forth, even statesmen like Representative Saitow, Senator Nemo, and Senator Fong Hur. What this bill does is it sticks to facts instead of using government agencies to promote racism and attacks on people as a race. Now, the fish, this group of fish called carp by species, looks most, as they say, like the grass, the big head, and silver carp taken from the Amur River that borders Russia and China. Because back then, when I was testifying on how they were using Asian carp, we did some research. Also, we found that it was being experimented on in a southern facility in Arkansas. And so hybrids got loose in the Mississippi River. The University of Minnesota testified about the hybrid carp reproducing so that there's species that are a mix of the big head and the silver. And as you heard, they were being called invasive species or invasive carp. However, I sat in on a round table of DNR people and others which were calling called them Asian carp as far as being invasive species, and in shortening the terms, they were referring to the Asian people as being invasive species. And the only species I know of is, as far as invasive, is what you see on TV, you know, in those alien shows. So anyway, this was offensive, and they also talked of starting advertising of Asian carp as invasive species and promoting the killing of invasive species. But more recently, both state and federal agencies were listed on a poster I saw at the airport saying, wanted, dead, not alive. In big letters, it said Asian, and in small letters, it said carp. The message was very clear. And on that, the federal and state agencies that were listed was the Department of U.S. Department of Wildlife and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And the last time government was involved in such issues was back in the Native American history when they talked about the massacres in the 1800s. So I think Minnesota has moved beyond that. I was hesitant in raising the issues again because I was threatened at the time, the last time I testified against the use of the name Asian, in calling it Asian carp. But I think that Senate File 2806 does stick to the facts and science, and it is a good model for the nation and puts the state in compliance with federal laws prohibiting discrimination based on race and state and federal laws that prohibits doing any harm to people. And I just refer to the fact because of things that have occurred, as I mentioned. And I further would like to say that Minnesota is a global competitor. Many companies and large companies make a lot of money doing international trade. So this bill would help increase as far as the revenue and jobs of these companies and future companies, and promote better international relationships, especially in the fields of medical devices, healthcare, IT, and manufacturing. And that's why in sitting in on some of these international discussions as far as business discussions, they don't use terminologies that are offensive to, in fact, you have to be very careful how you talk to people coming from other countries and wanting to do business here in Minnesota. So for that reason, we urge support of Senate File 2806. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Senator Rosen, you had a question?
Yes, just real quickly. I was just pulled up the Asian specific chapter, and it's quite large. It includes China. And do you know, Mr. Chair and members, that the first Chinese graduate from a university was the University of Minnesota.
What?
The first graduate of a...
Of the University of Minnesota.
A Chinese student was from the University of Minnesota. My question, though, to Senator Hoffman, though, is this is just on... This is from day of enactment. They don't have to go back and change statute.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, you know, we're not asking the DNR to pull back materials are already in the field. They're just going forward. So, no, that's why there's no fiscal note on this at all. It's just going forward. We're going to be, and we're already starting to make the changes, Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen. You know, the LCCMR and is starting to look at that as well. So,
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Might I suggest we move this to the consent calendar, but might we also send a committee recommendation that in lieu of sort of a cursory third reading, we actually have the author give us third reading on this?
I don't know if we can do that, but I suppose we could ask.
Senator Hoffman, look at line 1.9.
Oh, yes. I think that would be very nice to have the author have to read the scientific names.
Oh, you're funny. We were just laughing. Senator Benson, Mr. Chair, we were looking at hypothalic meclithus. I can't even say that right, but it's nobilis. That's an emolitex, and I have no clue. I got to go back to my Latin phraseology to figure out what that is. Isn't that amazing? We should refer it to that name, right?
I think, Senator Hoffman, you've been warned in advance that you better learn the pronunciation before the floor.
I will. You know, like Mr. Grant said earlier, Mr. Chair, definitions are problematic. I have a quote here. Earlier in today's thing, so
Senator Herr,
Mr. Chair, thank you. I hope that I'm not required to read that Latin word because it's quite difficult. I have little minor speech impediment, so I would prefer invasive cough. But I really appreciate Senator Hoffman and Ms. Herr and Ms. Lee for making a very concise and eloquent, you know, presentation. I would not have done better, even though I would be the chief author of this bill, you know, being that, you know, I'm not a trained public speaker until I took the Senate seat. And I'm very glad that you brought this forth. And I just want to express a word of appreciation because I represent a large constituents that this bill will reflect. And I'm speaking for them. Each of us, Senator, represent 80,000 constituents, so I want to express a word of gratitude for bringing this forward. And so is the DNR, too. I appreciate the DNR for their understanding.
Senator Hoffman, one quick question about it. The sentence on line 1.13 and 1.14, telling the commissioner not to propose laws to the legislature that contain that terminology. I have a feeling they are hearing this even if we don't do that. And I wondered if maybe you want to delete much of that sentence so it would just that paragraph would be the Commissioner of Natural Resources shall use the term invasive carp or refer to the specific species and then continue it on. Take out that first part. Is there a reason you want that first, or is it something we could take out?
Mr. Chair and members, I you know, you're bringing the positive before the negative, and I did the negative before the positive. So your language change actually makes it a lot cleaner. So it shall use the term versus you won't use. But I think, Mr. Chair, too, we also have to start small by saying, you know, we don't use these terms anymore. It's kind of like the word handicap. You know, you don't use that anymore. And still,
I don't mind leaving it where it is. I just wanted to ask.
Yeah.
If you
wanted I appreciate that. Yep.
Okay, Senator. Actually, even though Senator Hoffman's the author, Senator Benson had asked if we could put this on the consent calendar, and if so, Senator Hoffman, would you like to move that the bill be recommended, passed, and placed on the consent calendar?
You know, I'm open to either way. My thought was it would be rolled into inclusion into the omnibus bill, but if...
Oh, well, but you can... Anyway, you might as well move this. It could be added into the consent, into the omnibus bill, but okay.
Yeah,
any way you want.
Chair's discretion.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, I think it's your discretion.
Okay. Well, I'll suggest Senator Hoffman moves that Senate File 2806 be recommended pass and placed on the consent calendar.
Thank you.
Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Before we adjourn, the Senator Dibble's bill, I sent that to Finance Committee because I thought they wanted to see it, and I've been told they don't have any. There's nothing finance-related in that last bill, Senate File, I think it's 2049. Mm-hmm. which, and so I'm wondering if we could reconsider that and send it straight to the floor. If, is that okay with people? If so, Senator Coonan moves that the...
I wasn't here for that.
Oh, Senator Herr moves that the motion by which Senate File 2049 be sent to Finance Committee be reconsidered. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Herr moves that Senate File 2049 be, as amended, be recommended pass and sent to the floor. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. And I think this is the last meeting before deadline for this committee. So thank you all, and with that, this meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.